From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. What a night we have in store for you tonight and later on tonight. Is there a secret weapons program being tested on us? Stick around and find out on that one. Here's what's happening. In Missouri, the 18-year-old deceased Michael Brown's stepfather says he is sorry for his emotional outburst to demonstrators after learning that Officer Darren Wilson would not be indicted in the teen's death. But he says he's unfairly taking the heat for the rioting that followed. Now, despite Ferguson Police Chief Tom Jackson's assertion that police are investigating whether Lewis Head intended to incite a riot with his words, law enforcement say Head is unlikely to be prosecuted. Head has said that emotions got the best of him on the night of November 24th in Ferguson, Missouri, when he yelled, "Burn this blankety blank blank down." Another sad story, this time out of New York, though. A grand jury has decided not to charge a New York City police officer over the death of Eric Garner, a man placed in an apparent chokehold. Now, following the grand jury decision, crowds gathered in New York's Times Square to vent their frustration. Even President Barack Obama has said it speaks to larger issues between minorities and law enforcement. In the incident, the asthmatic Garner, he's 43 years old, was heard on the video shouting, "I can't breathe," as a number of officers restrained him in a street in New York. What was he there for? Why were they arresting him? Why were they trying to subdue him? He was selling loose cigarettes because some of the neighborhood stores that sell cigarettes got upset. Airstrikes carried out by the U.S.-led coalition on the Islamic State, ISIS, have inflicted significant damage on the group's capabilities, according to Secretary of State John Kerry. Mr. Kerry said the campaign against the militant group could take years, but that the coalition would remain engaged as long as it takes. Under pressure from federal regulators, Honda is expanding a recall of driver's side airbags to all 50 states. Now, these airbags made by a Japanese supplier can explode with too much force, sending metal shrapnel into the passenger compartment and hitting the drivers and passengers. One in eight middle-aged women in the United States apparently has depression, according to a new report. That means that women ages 40 to 59 have the highest rate of depression of any group based on age and gender in the U.S. Why? Let's check in with psychiatrist Peter Breggin. Peter, what's going on here? Middle-aged women, depression? What's the cause here?
Well, we've been getting a lot of statistics like this, and of course, women are much more on psychiatric drugs than men. I think it's complicated. First, women are more likely to report feelings of being depressed, being sad, just having feelings. And this is just a survey that they're asked to check off. And it doesn't cover drinking and getting angry, which is how men often in middle age show their depression. They drink and they get angry at their kids. So it isn't looking at the full range of stresses. And also women have more physical illness symptoms than men, although they live longer. And that would show up on a depression survey. But there are other things we could look at and think at least would be involved. And I actually went over this with my wife, Ginger. I wanted to get her viewpoint as well. Sure. For one thing, this is the age group of menopause, age 40 to 59. It corresponds exactly with the limits of the lower and upper limits of menopause. Most menopause falls right in the middle of age 40 to 59. And that can make people have trouble sleeping, make them feel sad, make them feel tired, and other things that are checked off on the list. This age group of women is loaded with antidepressants, although only 12% of women are, on this one survey at least, are checking off the symptoms of moderate to severe depression. 20% of women are taking antidepressants. That's going to give you all kinds of symptoms of depression. It's also the age of being an empty nester, George, and it's also the age of greatest work stress, and where women are going to have to they'll be working their hardest. Men are working their hardest. It's hard on the family. And, of course, women are also, in addition to working, often being the primary housekeeper, the primary caretaker in the family rather than the man.
So lots of pressure on them.
It puts extra pressure on them. And of course, my wife put it. She said, "It's time for middle age crises, yours or your husband's." Ginger said to me today. So you know, whether it's yours or your husband's middle age crisis is going to affect women. And women have all these different expectations. They're expected to work. They're expected to raise children. They're expected to take care of the house. And it just may be that it's very hard with all those modern expectations, which are highly imbalanced in terms of all that women are expected to do, that women end up being disappointed as they get older. You know, we can just think about all of these things, but I think what we really need, if we're going to have a survey, is to really ask men and women a lot more of what they actually think and feel, rather than just use a checklist. By the way, I found out this checklist sponsored by Pfizer. Then rather than just use a checklist, you just got to get in deeper about what people are really feeling.
And by the way, Peter has a new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and he's going to be a special guest on our program on December 10th, so make sure you're part of that. Peter, thank you. Eating a Mediterranean diet may be your key to living longer, that according to a new study. The associate professor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and Harvard's Medical School says this: the diet involves eating items off a menu which are rich in vegetables, fruits, nuts, beans, and peas, unrefined grains, olive oil, and fish. It keeps dairy, meat, and saturated fats to a minimum. And eating after the sun has gone down might trigger weight gain, according to researchers who've been studying the effect in mice. Even when given the same amount of calories overall, mice that ate around the clock put on more fat. Well, they say the Earth is now around 60 million years older than previously thought, and so is the moon, according to new researchers. Let's check in with Dr. Sky Stephen Cates on this one. Now, how do they know the Earth, after all these years, Stephen, is 60 million years older than previous?
Well, George, this is very complicated, but to make it simple to all the audience out there, this is basically what we know. The oldest rocks in the solar system are dated at about 4.57 billion years old. And a team of French scientists have just uncovered kind of like a similar way to what we would carbon date things. They've come up with a way to analyze xenon gases that are inside quartz rocks that they found in Australia and other locations, finding out that these particular molecules or gas bubbles in there can actually be dated. And what's interesting about this, George, it adds more timeline to the solar system's creation. But what's even more fascinating to many out there that are listening, everybody's probably wondering, where did the moon actually come from? And the theory, of course, is this, that a Mars-like object actually grazed the Earth during those early billion years ago time and pulled material out of the Earth to form the moon. But it's interesting to note this, that if these scientists, and by the way, let me qualify this, they're not saying that this is an absolute. This is something that they're still, you know, doing their journals and sending their scientific information across the world. But it's fascinating, George, that we live in a place that's a lot older, obviously, than what we thought. But in conclusion, George, if we now go to the sky, this weekend starts a fascinating event in the sky, the Geminid meteor shower. People are seeing all across the nation and around the world bright lights being the shooting stars and fireballs out of the northeast. It'll peak around the 14th. The beautiful long night moon occurs this weekend on the 6th. And George, finally, from space, we all have our fingers crossed for this Orion exploration flight test number one, hopefully tomorrow, 7 o'clock in the morning. But it's actually coming out of the same location that the early Apollo test rockets were launched from, this launch pad 37. So we wish them all the best as we date the Earth and the moon. Hopefully one day we'll return to that object that we started our conversation off, the moon itself.
Would be exciting. Stephen, thank you so much. Well, they say this year is in the running to be the hottest globally ever. In the first 10 months of 2014, global average air temperatures were above the long-term average. But according to one scientist, it may not be what you think. In a moment, I'll be talking to what many people believe to be the best climate predictor in the United States, maybe the world, author of Dark Winter and also Cold Sun, John Casey. He's next with me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, we have had many experts on this program talking about climate change, but this may be the one. This may be the person whose views are very similar to what we've been talking about on this program for a long time. And people are starting to wake up. Let me tell you a little bit about John Casey, former White House Space Advisor Program Director. He's a consultant to NASA's headquarters with the space shuttle as an engineer. He was one of America's most successful climate change researchers and predictors. Mr. Casey is the leading advocate in the United States for a national and international plan to prepare for the next climate change, to one of a dangerous cold climate era. Unlike many people who are saying it's a warming point, in this cold era, he believes, is caused by a historic decline in the sun's energy output. But we'll have him talk about what he calls a solar hibernation. John, welcome to the program. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, George.
You know, we have for years been talking about what the heck is happening to climate, and, you know, people jump in and they say it's man-made, it's related. I've always said that it's, you know, and I'm not a scientist, John. I've always believed that the sun had a lot to do with it. And as I began reading your works, lo and behold, here's an expert, probably one of the best, who is saying that. So it's refreshing to hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you for saying so, but I'm not the only one. Fortunately, since I began this effort almost 8 years ago, there have been a number of other researchers who have now come out publicly, not only producing research papers that back up my research, but producing their own books, just like I have with Cold Sun and Dark Winter. So it's good to see the community growing.
Tell us a little bit more, John, about yourself and what led you to believe in these theories that led you to write Cold Sun and also Dark Winter.
Well, actually, it was back in early 2007. I was starting to get ready to retire. I had had what I thought was a pretty dynamic career. I'd done a lot of work for the White House, NASA headquarters, Congress, run a number of high-tech startup companies, helped start a number of companies. And so was trying to get ready for retirement, started a book. And in the process of getting the book going, I had a chapter on solar behavior in that book. I had no intention whatsoever of getting into climate change. But in the process of completing some solar research, I uncovered some cycles of the sun that are in fact the primary drivers of climate change on a scale of a couple or 400 years. So it was that beginning that led me to not only not retire, but to change my life fundamentally and help get our people aware of what the causes and effects of climate change really are.
Now, the story I had right before you came on with me, John, some researchers are saying that this could be by far the warmest year on record. How do we react to that when we're talking about cold spells? And in your case, a 30-year cold spell.
Well, there are a lot of folks that have heard about that. In fact, NOAA tried to sell that back in 2012. It was going to be the warmest year on record. But Mother Nature decided to cancel that plan of NOAA's back then. And as we've all seen, November was an extremely bitter cold period. And once you start factoring in the November and December temperatures, which are expected to get through a warm period and then start getting back to cold fairly quick toward the end of the month, we'll probably see that goal of NOAA to pass away like the others have. Fundamentally, the facts of the climate, which most people, unfortunately, with the exception of listening to shows like yours, are really quite different than what the government's been telling us. As most in our community know, there is no global warming. There has not been for many years. And now we know with fair certainty that the Earth has been cooling for quite some time.
How do you make the predictions you make, John? And they've been pretty uncanny. I mean, all the way from not only weather-related predictions, but earthquakes as well. How do you do this?
Well, the basic principle is following solar cycles, solar behavior, measuring the various components that contribute to climate change. In my company, the Space and Science Research Corporation, every 6 months, for example, we issue a global climate status report. The GCSR measures 24 different parameters that contribute to global climate change. And by the way, greenhouse gas and mankind CO2 is not even on the list, since it's a nearly insignificant component to climate change at the current level of parts per million that we have in the atmosphere.
John, why is this so emotional? I mean, when you talk to people on either end of the spectrum on climate change and the causes for it and the root causes for it, it's an emotional discussion. It's not just a conversation of two people. It's a hot and heavy discussion. Why is it that way?
The generation that we're in, I think, has a lot to do with it, George. If we look back in history for how the modern environmental movement got going, we're now talking about this global warming idea has been injected into probably the most environmentally sensitive and environmentally conscious generation that the human race has ever had. So the timing was perfect for people to hear about some idea, some reason for climate change, especially one that has been politically manipulated to take advantage of that situation. So people are sensitive about the climate, they're sensitive about caring for the earth, about ending pollution, about making the planet happy and healthy. And within that context, that seems to be the background for why people are so sensitive to it, number one. And they're very sensitive to any objections that people raise that confront this modern myth of man-made global warming as a result.
And most of us, of course, don't want pollution. But I think a lot of people are confusing pollution with warming, and they just can't cut the two, you know, and make a differential between them.
That's really a very key point. Separating pollution from climate change is a big issue. Again, after decades of worrying about and seeing about pollution controls and the need to control pollution, not just in the U.S., but globally, that's given people the impression they're tied together intimately. They are not. The climate varies on natural cycles, is driven by the sun primarily, and pollution is a product of mankind. So we're talking about two fundamentally different causes and effects.
Well, with John Casey, author of a couple works. One is called Cold Sun, the other is Dark Winter. One of my guests, John Robert Felix, who happens to have been a retired architect, wrote a book called Not by Fire, But by Ice. He believes, and he's not a credentialed person, but he's done 8 years of solid research, he believes we're in the beginning stages of a mini ice age.
Robert Felix is, you may say, not credentialed, but he has done an outstanding job in researching his subject. I have both of his books, by the way. So I am an admirer of Robert's ability to dig into the facts and put together a scenario for the future. Now, what Robert talks about that's different than mine is a global ice age like the one we had 115, 120,000 years ago, and that's the cycle with which they come around. By a lot of accounts, and certainly according to the research Robert's done, we are very near the drop-off point into a new global ice age, in fact. So he backs that up with good, solid research, and he should be commended for getting a lot of facts out that a lot of people are simply not aware of. My research focuses on a more near-term solar cycle, one that's 206 years long, which really accounts for most of the climate variation we've had since our country was founded. And so that's why I developed the relational cycle theory, cycles that we can relate to in our lifetime, our parents' lifetime, our grandchildren's lifetime. And I think those are more necessary to hear about right now.
And we're going to come back in a moment, John, as you talk about the sun is causing a 30-year cold spell. Just how cold is that going to get? We'll be back. Well, some of the conclusions by John Casey and his organization, Space and Science Research Corporation, of course, has to do with the Earth about to begin a steep drop in global temperatures. So we'll get into all of this with him when we come back in a moment. Welcome back to Coast to Coast, back with John Casey. So, John, this 30-year cold spell, just how cold will it get?
Well, certainly there's no one on the planet that has been through the kind of cold we're about to see.
Oh,
this is a revisit of a phenomenon of what we call a solar hibernation, when the sun cuts back dramatically on the amount of energy that it uses to warm the planet. As a result, we get cold. In the past, the sun was very active and the planet was warm. We had so-called real global warming caused by the sun, not mankind. But we've passed through that phase now. We're on the downside of this solar hibernation caused by that same 206-year solar cycle. So as we proceed further, we're going to see more and more cold, more record cold, until we get to the bottom of this cold phase, which will be in the early 2030s.
Will the seasons change at all, John, or will they just be more frigid temperatures in the wintertime?
We're going to get colder winters and longer winters. We're still going to have four seasons,
okay, as
always, but it's going to be the brutality of the winters, especially during planting time in the spring, where we'll see planting that's attempted but frozen out, and that will lead to a second or a third attempt at a planting in the wheat, corn, and soybean crops belts, and some of those will fail as well. And once you get to the third planting, then you're in pretty deep trouble in terms of harvest on the back end. But then we'll also see very early freezes and snows that will affect harvest of crops. So we're going to get it on both ends. And again, this is merely a repeat of this highly reliable cycle. And going back in time, looking at history, we see the same event every time. We see massive crop damage leading to lots of other problems as a result.
I do a lot of flying, John, all over the country, and many times I'm flying over like Lake Mead in areas like that where I have noticed, even just in the past several years of flying, a significant drop in the water levels there. That's scary too, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but the drought conditions that we've seen, especially in the Southwest and Texas and California, May be part of another 60-year cycle that's part of the small family of cycles defined by the relational cycle theory that affect things like drought, like intensive rains. But as we get closer to the cold bottom phase in the late 2020s and 2030s, that will start to turn back around. Data shows that we have increased precipitation during the worst of these cold spells.
The United Nations, of course, pushing more and more for funding of projects regarding man-made global warming. The United States has spent billions of dollars studying this as well. Why are they spending so much money on this?
Well, the money is being spent to prop up the myth of man-made climate change, which in turn is being used to prop up what appears to be a socialist agenda in various countries. It's come out of the UN, the UN Environmental Program, and the UN United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was founded in 1988, and since that time has been putting out climate reports based on the greenhouse gas theory and mankind's CO2 emissions ever since. But again, the objective, even when this movement got started, the global warming movement, was always a political agenda using the greenhouse gas theory, historically a very weak theory, simply as a convenient tool. The science was never really there. All the money was put into it to make it into a good theory. But now after 30 years, and in the U.S., probably more than $30 billion spent on it, we now know that all the climate models developed from the theory have been utter failures. They simply failed to reproduce climate based on that theory, which, of course, many of us who've been studying this have anticipated all along.
Now, the scientists who back up man-made global warming, why do they continue then to run with the gauntlet and tell the world that this is the way it is?
Well, there are a lot of folks who have looked at that particular issue, but the conclusion, unfortunately, defined in books like ClimateGate by Brian Sussman, yeah, The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science by Dr. Tim Ball, and many others, have exposed some unfortunate facts of the scientists who are actually involved in this, especially at the UN. Sadly, it looks like a lot of these so-called leading scientists at the UN had been manipulating the data, corrupting the data, hiding the trend of global cooling, and this so-called pause, the end of global warming, in fact. So it's not a good sign, but it does look like that in order to gain fortune and fame, a lot of scientists were, in fact, corrupted by this process.
And so when we get into this dark winter, of course, and then the crop season gets all screwed up and everything else, we're talking about the possibility of a lot of people starving to death on this planet, aren't we?
Well, unfortunately, we are, and that's not based on the cycle, per se. It's based on what the cycle does reliably predict. And if you look back in history, the same effects come every time the cycle comes around. We lose crops, people starve, other civil disturbances, riots, and some say it's also tied to the war cycle. Clearly, we do have more intense warfare during these cold eras. And the last time this happened here in the U.S., from 1793 to 1830, which is also roughly called the Dalton Minimum, we had a time which was very difficult. We were in the midst of, in fact, the War of 1812 at the bottom of this solar hibernation cycle back then. So clearly there was lots of warfare going on, but we also had thousands of American citizens that starved to death and froze to death because the climate, the cold era, was so brutal.
When so many people are so concerned about this and it hits in a big, quick way, are we going to be short of natural resources in the winter, like natural gas or heating oil for people's homes on the East Coast?
Apparently we will be, although we have a very resilient society and technically have advanced greatly since the last time this solar hibernation hit. Unfortunately, we now have a power grid, a power industry that is simply not even preparing for this new cold era, where the demands for heating and so forth will be far greater than we've ever seen before. I'm very concerned about that aspect, not that we can't get through it, but the fact that we're simply not preparing for it.
That's dangerous. What about the intensity or lack of sunspots? Does that have anything to do with this?
Very much so, George. The central measurement of solar activity that is so reliable in the RC theory is the counting of sunspots, the analysis of trends of sunspots and sunspot data. And going back to when the first telescope was made popular by Galileo in the early 1600s, we've been counting sunspots all during that time. What we know is that with great certainty that as sunspots drop to a low number, we're talking below an average 50 sunspots, we get very cold. During the so-called Little Ice Age from roughly 1615 to 1745, it was a period of time when there were virtually no sunspots at all. So And we look at the global warming side of the equation, we see a maximum number of sunspots when it's warm. So even though Al Gore has called me a pseudoscientist who counts sunspots, in fact, it's that simple. Counting sunspots gives us the best idea for which way the climate is heading.
You know, when we came close to the Mayan calendar date of December 21st, 2012, lots of us talked and tried to speculate on what could happen. I always thought that we could have some kind of huge solar event. I'm not sure we had the huge solar event, but we have had many solar events. Do you think that was tied into anything, that Mayan calendar date?
Well, I've looked at that, actually. In fact, it was part of that original book that got me doing the solar research. But the period of peak solar activity for the last 19, 11-year solar cycles, in fact, was during that year 2000, 2012 kind of thing. I mean, if you go back and look at the trend data, we could see that clearly the sun was going to be at its most active peak right around that period. And it was part of my early predictions and notification to the White House and the mainstream media of the fact that global warming, like the sun, was going to peak and then very quickly go into a cold cycle. And that, in fact, did happen. The fact that it was tied to the Mayan calendar, certainly a very strong coincidence. But other than that, from a scientific standpoint, I think it's simply a matter of looking at the sun. The Mayans, of course, were great astronomers. That's the benefit we have from them.
They sure were. Now, when you formed Space and Science Research Corp, what was your mission? What did you set out to do?
Well, very clearly, after the initial discovery of the relational cycle theory, and especially the impact of this 206-year cycle, I realized when I discovered all this back in April of 2007 that no way was I going to retire. I had found a new mission, which was to get the word out as quickly as I could to our leaders in Washington and to the American people that we had been on the totally wrong track about climate change, and that, in fact, a new potentially dangerous cold era was coming, and we needed to start preparing for it.
Well, are people starting to listen now to what you have to say, John?
Well, I must tell you, George, that initially I met a lot of resistance, but over the years the word has been spreading. Other scientists are stepping up to the plate and talking about it. There's been a very large growing body of folks who've been confronting this myth of man-made global warming and the what I call the greatest scientific fraud in history, the use of the greenhouse gas theory for political purposes. That's been going on. But I do see a growing number of people now addressing global cooling, which hasn't happened.
Okay, so when you say that the sun is going to be in a 30-year cold spell, after the 30 years, generally, what's going to happen?
Well, of course, the cycle goes up and down. If you look at the temperature curve over hundreds of years, after the 2030s and the 2040s arrive, and we get into the 2050s, things will warm up again. The nature of this cycle, however, in our further research shows that even though it will start to warm up, it will be only moderately so. I believe this last period of global warming that we've been through will in fact be the last such warm period for quite some time for the human race. The next warm period will be a moderate warm period, but certainly nothing to compare with what we've just left.
So we give it our hold on. It's going to be like one of those roller coaster rides. If you're not strapped in, you could fall out.
Well, you might fall out if you don't prepare for it, and that's what the mission of the Space and Science Research Corporation is. Get everyone prepared, get them informed so they're not shocked or surprised by what happens to the crops once this really bad cold spreads and becomes deep-seated for the next 30 years.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of your work in the area of earthquakes, John?
Sure can. I was honored back in 2011 when a group of scientists came to me after looking at my climate research. And these scientists are some of the best geologists on the planet. And they had said that they liked what I was doing and wanted me to help them do something similar with regard to earthquake and volcano prediction. The group that we formed, the International Earthquake and Volcano Prediction Center, has in fact already begun to predict major earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. And the most interesting facet of this new cold era is that research shows a very strong correlation between the worst earthquakes and the worst volcanic eruptions at the very bottom of these solar hibernations. If we look back to the last one, for example, the worst series of earthquakes ever recorded on the planet and the largest volcanic eruption ever recorded all took place during the last solar hibernation, almost within a few years of each other. The earthquake was the New Madrid series of quakes south of St. Louis. We had two roughly 7.5s and an 8.0 quake within months of each other.
Yeah. Which changed the direction of the Mississippi, didn't it?
Absolutely did. It flowed backward for a while, then redirected. The so-called Real Foot Lake is what used to be the Mississippi River. If you look at your map or in that area, you can see the Real Foot Lake. But it lifted up that land mass, and that was a very, very powerful, like I say, the worst series of earthquakes ever recorded. And at the same time, by the way, that was 1811 to 1812, and then we had in 1815 the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia, which made the cold era much, much colder.
And guess where I'm broadcasting from as we speak, John? St. Louis. I'm probably right on top of the New Madrid Fault.
Yes, you are, sir. Yep.
And then I, of course, go back to Los Angeles, where I'm on the San Andreas Fault. I don't think I can get away from it. One place or another, I'm going to get zapped.
Well, at least I hope you're informed.
Yeah, exactly. Can you predict where these events could occur?
Well, certainly the IEVPC, the International Earthquake and Volcano Prediction Center, began its work. We've tried to find some funding to do it. But like climate change, the dogma of the day says that people cannot predict earthquakes and cannot predict volcanic eruptions. Even though that group has been able to do so, we still face that that barrier of science, just like we have on the climate side. We were told, for example, that no one can predict climate change. People still say that today, even though we have shown over these last 8 years that we can, in fact, predict climate change, and we have made a number of climate predictions that have been independently verified as not only happening when we said, but how we said it would occur. So we're really talking about breaking down barriers of science, both in earthquake prediction and in climate prediction.
Okay, well, stay with us with John Casey. We're going to come back for another hour of discussion with him, and we'll take your phone calls as well. You may not agree with what Mr. Casey has to say, but let's just keep the dialogue moving along here. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com.